Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Today we go behind the headlines with one of the country's top public health leaders to look at how concerned we really ought to be about the spread of Ebola to the United States and to Georgia.
It's a very scary disease. It has a very high fatality rate and there's no known cure, but we do have a way to stop the epidemic.
Then, the National Black Arts Festival has become one of the outstanding American showcases for the work of artists from the African diaspora. We'll look at the impact of the festival on our life here in Atlanta and around the world.
It's important to be able to acknowledge the contributions of a group of people and the influence that they've had on art and culture around the world.
Then on the anniversary of his birth, we remember the career of a Georgia political leader who became known as a progressive force, but was a leader in promoting segregation. But first, the news. There was no competition for the top news story in Georgia this week.
These are live pictures from Emory University Hospital where Dr. Kent Brantley is resting tonight. He is in a special isolation room specifically designed to handle the most dangerous diseases.
Like both of the Americans fighting the deadly Ebola virus are here in Atlanta.
With the arrival of Dr. Kent Brantley and Nancy Reitball at Emory University Hospital, there's probably no city, no state more aware of the fight to stop the spread of Ebola than we are here in Atlanta and Georgia. All of us have been asking so many questions about the disease. Is there even a slight chance that the isolation units at Emory won't do the job they're built to do? Will Ebola be contained in the four countries in West Africa that are now seeing the biggest outbreak since the disease was first discovered? And what can this country do to help fight the terrible toll Ebola is taking in Africa today? This seemed to me to be the right moment to call upon Dr. Mark Rosenberg, director of the Task Force for Global Health in Decatur, Georgia. Dr. Rosenberg is one of the nation's most highly respected public health leaders. His organization works routinely with CDC, the World Health Organization, and other global public health agencies to treat rampant diseases around the world. While the task force isn't dealing directly with Ebola, Dr. Rosenberg is well-versed in fighting dangerous infectious disease, and he works closely with many of the people who will be attacking the Ebola epidemic. Dr. Rosenberg joined me in the GPB studios this week.
It is scary. It's a very scary disease. It has a very high fatality rate, and there's no known cure. There's no vaccine to protect us against it. But we do have a way to stop the epidemic. Yet, it is reasonable for us to worry about it. I don't think we should be panicked, but I think this is something that should be of concern to us.
When you say we, do you mean in the general sense, all of us should be worried about whether Ebola might spread from West Africa where it is today? Or are you saying we here in Atlanta, where there are now two Ebola patients at Emory, should be even more concerned?
I think we should be very concerned about the problem of Ebola. First, I don't think we have to worry about getting infected by the two patients who are at Emory. In fact, having them at Emory raises our level of awareness about the problem. It increases our level of understanding about what's going on, and that's a very good thing. But those patients are under very strict isolation. We are very, very safe from that. What we should worry about is something else. First, we should be worried that people are being infected and are dying of this and getting deathly ill of this in West Africa. I think the death of those people and the illness that they suffer diminishes us as human beings on this planet. So we should be concerned and we should absolutely be worried, but we should be worried about them there. The second thing we should worry about is that this disease could be imported into the United States. If it comes, it won't be imported by two people who have already been identified and under strict isolation. If it comes here, it will be brought in by someone who got infected and wasn't aware that they were infected, and they're not yet seriously ill with the disease. It can have an incubation period of 2 to 3 weeks. So people have a long time of being infected but not ill. And so if it gets brought in, we should be more concerned that it would be brought in by someone who is not an identified patient.
Is there, given our global economy, an inevitability that Ebola will find its way here?
I don't think it's inevitable, but I think it's a high enough probability that we should be concerned about it and we should take steps to minimize the risk. The first and the most important thing that we do to protect us here is to treat them there. We need to take the basic steps to bring this epidemic in West Africa under control. And this is the largest Ebola epidemic we have ever seen. It's the largest one we've ever been aware of. But it still could be stopped, even without a vaccine and even without specific curative drugs, it can be stopped. And the steps are not complicated. First, you have to find the people who are sick from it. Then you have to confirm the diagnosis. And then if you confirm that it is Ebola, you want to isolate them. You want to take care of them under conditions that their illness cannot spread to others, cannot spread to other family members, community members, or the people taking care of them. But we can do that. They can do that. They can isolate them and take care of them that way. And then the fourth step is you need to trace their contacts. Who might they have been in contact with while they were actually infectious? And you want to find those people and isolate them as well until they are through with a potential incubation period. If they don't become sick, if they show no signs of illness, you let them go. If they come down with illness, you want to isolate them and treat them as a patient. These steps will prevent the spread. These steps will stop the epidemic.
Is there a public health infrastructure in place in these countries that will allow for what you're talking about, that could do the things you're saying?
They have people in these countries who can do this, but they don't have enough, and they don't have enough people trained, and they don't have enough facilities, and they don't have adequate supplies. So there's a tremendous need to support them and build up their infrastructure, and we are not investing enough. I think if you, just to get a very rough idea of what kind of investment might be useful here, look at the patients at Emory. And I know that the costs differ here in the United States and in Guinea or Sierra Leone, but just to give you an idea of what the real costs might be. So the patients being taken here, care of here at Emory, there were two. And it probably costs around $10,000 a day to take care of them the way they're being taken care of. They will probably each be there for about 30 days. So for these two patients, the costs are probably going to be about $600,000. That's just for their course of illness. Again, granted, there are differences in costs between here and there, but just as a very, very rough baseline. So there are probably at least 2,000 patients in the four countries we're talking about. So if we multiply by 2,000 times 600,000, you're talking about $1.2 billion. And they don't even have the hospitals yet. They don't even have the supplies there. They need to train the people and get them up to speed quickly. So I would say that $1.2 billion is not far off of what's needed. Right now, we're not coming close to what's needed. And the problem is that we keep falling further and further behind. If anything, we've got to get ahead of the curve. But people don't understand how important prevention is, and they don't invest adequately until the epidemic has gotten way out of hand. What we need to do is invest now. And there are some extraordinary leaders that are positioned around the world, really, really wonderful people. The head of the World Health Organization, Margaret Chan, has actually stopped epidemics when she was working before and working now at the World Health Organization. She's very committed, and she said that the World Health Organization needs $100 million right now for the three first countries that were infected. The director of CDC, Tom Frieden, an extraordinary person, and we're really lucky to have him in his job. He knows that we need to invest, and he's ready to send 50 people from CDC to help. And Jim Kim, the president of the World Bank, is a global leader in global health, an extraordinary man. And he says that the World Bank is ready to invest $200 million. So there you have maybe $350 million. It's maybe about a quarter of the way where we ought to be. But we are lucky to have those people in leadership positions. We need to keep up our investment to get ahead of this curve.
There's been some concern expressed this week in those countries that the experimental drug now being given to the two patients here doesn't seem to be on the horizon for use in any of those countries. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Well, first, we don't know that these experimental drugs are effective. They haven't been tested. They haven't been tested in clinical trials. There's some very exciting evidence from animal experiments that antibody products, products that attack the virus inside the animal body, can be effective in preventing it. So it's been very effective in preventing the disease in monkeys at the first stage. But we don't know that these drugs or other similar drugs or other antibodies in serum or transfusions from previously infected people will be protective. We need the research desperately, desperately to start this research so that we can find out if this is the trail we should pursue, if this is a path worth going down. These drugs are available here. They could be made more broadly available, but first we have to prove that these are the right medicines for this epidemic.
At the very least, I would think that it is dispiriting, demoralizing, to think that a drug is being tried out here on patients here in the United States, but is not being tried out in those countries. For those people, it must be a very stark recognition or sense that they don't matter as much somehow.
I think we need to share our resources with the people over there, and we do need to be very concerned with them. We should be a compassionate people. And that means we care about what's happening to other people, and we respond. There are many ways we can respond. There are many ways we can respond effectively, even without the drug that works. So we can wait to find out if it really works. I think what people there are really scared of is losing their children, losing their siblings, losing their community, losing their doctors. It's a very, very scary process, and they don't have isolation rooms. They don't have enough doctors and nurses. They don't even have an understanding of what causes the illness. So you may have read about that when people are frustrated, they take out their frustrations on people who may actually be there to help them. So that in certain villages, people deny that this is Ebola. Denials are primitive mechanism, but it protects you from things that are really scary sometimes, but it doesn't protect you from the infection. It doesn't protect you from the disease. But we've got to get basic health information out to people to let them understand what Ebola is, how it can be stopped, why people should be diagnosed and isolated and quarantined and protected. We've got to get out the basic information.
If I may, let me talk again about the concern about it being imported into this country and to countries around the world. Delta Airlines has suggested this week that perhaps they are going to set up some sort of health screenings for passengers who are arriving back from the four African nations that have had outbreaks of Ebola. Is that a sensible precaution? Is it overreacting? Is it likely to set up a more of a panic reaction from people, do you believe?
I hope it won't set up a panic. But I think everyone ought to be worried about this. We talked about why they should be worried, both because there is a risk of importation and because people are dying from an epidemic that's going to get worse before it gets better.
So can an airline do a health screening that would stop people from entering the country? Is that a feasible approach?
I think it's important when the risk approaches a certain threshold to screen people for febrile illness and then to ask them more questions. And I think the public health doctors in this country have to decide when that's an appropriate step. I think passengers on airplanes are not at great risk from riding next to people with a fever, because chances are that febrile illness is not Ebola.
What is febrile illness?
It's sickness that causes a fever. That's all we're saying. They have an elevated temperature. Most of the time, their temperature is going to be elevated because they have what we would call the common cold. They have a disease that's not very serious, not very threatening, or they have some self-contained infection that's not very contagious. So most people are not going to be at risk from sitting next to someone with a fever or Ebola.
But someone could be a carrier, enter the country, and then pass the disease along to someone they are intimate with. So that's why I ask about the health screenings, whether that makes sense.
I think at a certain point, when the risk is at a certain level, it does make sense. And it depends on how effectively and efficiently we can conduct the health screening. If it means everyone with a fever has to wait for 2 or 3 hours and they're delayed, that may not be very efficient or very effective. If it means we create long, long lines to get through customs, that may not be very efficient or effective.
Not to mention that that kind of screening might put an even bigger fear into people, don't you think?
I don't think we've been scared too much. It is a scary disease. It's a very scary disease.
What happens in Ebola to a patient?
The patient first becomes infected. The virus gets inside of them and it gets into their blood system. The virus spreads, and it takes a while for it to spread and to multiply, so that a small infectious dose becomes a very large infectious quantity of virus particles. And with Ebola, the person typically develops a headache, fever, shock-like symptoms of dehydration. They can start to have small hemorrhages because their clotting mechanisms don't work. And they can sometimes have frank bleeding. They can be coughing up blood or have blood in their feces or urine. And once the hemorrhaging starts, they're very susceptible to going into shock. So this is the process that happens. And again, it occurs over maybe 5 to 21 days of incubation. The process is a scary, frightening process. And the fatality rates reportedly have been very high. It varies in different places, and it may vary by different strains of the Ebola virus. And there are several different strains that have been reported, but the fatality rates are very high. 40% fatality is very high, and the rates range from 40 to 80 to 90% fatality rates. We don't know what the fatality rates would be in people in the United States who may be healthy to begin with and then can get supportive care at their hospital. We don't know the fatality rates for here because we haven't had Ebola virus epidemics here.
You've been in public health virtually your entire career. You've traveled the world dealing with public health threats. You've had many, many colleagues, some of whom are very well known, who have fought disease around the world. It strikes me that there is a great deal of courage and resolution and dedication involved when a public health worker, either here at Emory University Hospital, says, yes, I'll give up my vacation and volunteer to work with these two patients here, or says, yes, I will go to the site of this epidemic and work to deal with this disease. What sort of person is it that's willing to take those risks?
I think people who work in public health are, by and large, very committed to helping others. And they take risks on for themselves. In their travel, they take on risks. In going to work in countries where there is no Ebola epidemic, they take on risks. But what kind of people are public health people? I think there are extraordinary heroes who work in public health. I think the people who work for CDC are, by and large, extraordinary public servants. We have so many unsung heroes. I think the people who work for Doctors Without Borders are tremendously committed, selfless people who go to high-risk places to help very poor people in need of medical care and attention. there are thousands and thousands of very committed people working on this epidemic of Ebola. It brings us back, Bill, to what we were talking about is why we should be worried and why we should be concerned. And I want to go back to, there's a philosopher of surveillance. Surveillance is the public health practice where you actually go out and find all the cases. You look for all the people who might be sick. And if we did surveillance for Ebola, we might find there's not about 2,000 cases, but we might find that there are actually 6,000 or 8,000 or 12,000 cases. But surveillance means you watch out for cases. And basically, this philosopher of surveillance said that there are two types of surveillance that we can do. One is I and it surveillance. And it says, I have to watch out for it because of the threat it poses to me. So I in the United States should watch out for any diseases that might be a risk for me and my family here. So an infectious agent like Ebola, if it's brought in here, could infect us, and I should watch out because I need to protect us. Multi-drug-resistant TB, if brought in here, might threaten my community, infect us. I need to watch out for that because it's a threat to us. But this philosopher said that there's another type of surveillance, and that's I and thou surveillance. And it says, I need to watch out for where people are sick and dying because their death and their illness diminishes me as a human being. Because I care, because I feel for them, and I act based on my feelings. This is the I and thou surveillance. The philosopher was Martin Buber, and he talked about I and thou. I kind of embellished the surveillance part of it, but I find that the way he talks about I and thou and I and it are so appropriate and so helpful to understand this particular problem. In the case of Ebola, we don't have to choose between I and it and I and thou, because the very same thing that will protect us here, the I and it surveillance, the security, the health security idea, is the very same idea that needs to be put in place there, because protecting the people there is the way to protect us here. Helping the people there is the way to protect our country. It's one and the same thing that we've got to do.
Dr. Mark Rosenberg, it's wonderful to have you here to help us understand a little bit more about this dreadful disease that we're now learning so much about. Thank you for coming in and being part of the program today.
Well, thanks, Bill. Your questions were really good, and thanks for this chance to talk about something that's really, really important that people should be worried about.
Dr. Mark Rosenberg is the director of the Task Force for Global Health in Decatur, Georgia. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll be back in a moment with a change of pace, a look at an Atlanta arts festival that has become one of the world's most important showcases for the work of Black performing and visual artists. You're listening to Two-Way Street.
Hallelujah. Give me a new day. Give me a new day. I don't want yesterday.
The National Black Arts Festival is underway in Atlanta. The festival was founded by the Fulton County Arts Council as a way of celebrating the work of artists of African descent. The founders also thought it might be a great way to put Atlanta on the map as a center for black arts. NBAF presents the work of artists from the United States, Africa, the Caribbean, Europe, and Latin America. Over the years, it's attracted stars like Spike Lee, Maya Angelou, Harry Belafonte, Pearl Clegg, Elfrey Woodard, Nikki Giovanni, and so many more. This year, the festival is being run by the chairman of the NBAF board, Sonia Halpern. Halpern's a good choice. Her love of the arts began when she was a young girl growing up in New York State. She was a high school musician and a lover of theater. As an adult, Halpern was appointed by President Obama to be a member of the President's Advisory Committee on the Arts to the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington. As the National Black Arts Festival searches for a new executive director, Sonia Halpern has stepped into that role temporarily. As you listen to our conversation, I think it'll become quickly apparent she loves playing that role.
The National Black Arts Festival is the oldest multidisciplinary arts festival in the country, focused on the art and artists of African descent. It's the only institution of its kind in Atlanta. And every day we are focused on presenting, celebrating, and educating diverse audiences about the art and culture coming out of the diaspora.
And how long has it been going on?
This is its 26th year, founded in 1988 by the Fulton County Board of Commissioners, and 26 years later, here we stand.
Why is celebrating the art of African Americans, of people around the world of African descent, why is that different from celebrating all arts?
In some ways, it's not at all different. In fact, we all, I think, approach it in the same way. But I think that the critical difference is that it's important to be able to acknowledge the contributions of a group of people and the influence that they've had on art and culture around the world. And I think without institutions like NBAF, that does not necessarily happen.
People of African descent do all sorts of art.
Right.
But are there some themes? Are there some characteristics that you think in some way unite them?
In general, I think that there are some characteristics that unite them, and I think that comes from the culture and from the people. And I think that there are a lot of roots in different kinds of genres of art, including jazz as an example, that really come out of African-American experience that then go on to become really widespread and well-known and well-loved, but many people don't understand the roots of the music itself.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in a small town about an hour north of New York City, but we moved around a bit, so I also lived in Central Jersey, right outside of Princeton. Then we moved when I graduated from high school, and I went away to college in Massachusetts at UMass Amherst. Then I lived in Paris for a year while in graduate school, and then in New York for 8 years before I settled here in Atlanta, and I've been here for 16 years now.
Were the arts an important part of your life from an early age? Were your parents the kind of family that wanted to give you the arts as a gift?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I was in second grade, I started taking piano lessons. And it's interesting because I went on to take flute when it got to junior high and you could choose an instrument for band. I chose flute and I loved the flute. And then when I got to high school, I wanted to be in the marching band. But the marching band had too many piccolos already. So the music director, who was brilliant, really suggested that I try the alto saxophone because it is the same keying with the exception of one note as the flute, and I could learn how to blow through the reed.
Did you, Broadway theater part of your life?
Absolutely.
Did you learn to love theater? Talk about that.
So each year we would go at the holidays, we would get tickets and we would go as a family to see a show, and it really is where I grew to love musical theater. So we would go and see shows like Jelly's Last Jam, and we'd see The Wiz with Stephanie Mills, and we'd see Ain't Misbehavin'. I mean, every year we would go and see a show. In school, I remember going to the city and seeing Annie on Broadway. So my love of musical theater actually really is rooted in my experiences and going and seeing Broadway and off-Broadway shows.
So it's interesting, the shows that you named, because in a way you anticipated what I was going to ask you next, which is, for many of us, certainly for me as a white guy, I too, from an early age, was exposed to Broadway theater. I'm much older than you, so for me it was shows like My Fair Lady, white musicals. You were already, at an earlier age, being introduced to the art of black composers, mm-hmm. black performers. This came early in your life.
Right. But I think it's important because I think that, you know, you also need to see examples of people who look like yourself doing things and creating experiences and sharing what those are. And I grew up in a predominantly white community, like I said, an hour north of New York City. So in my own community, there was not a lot of that. So I think it does become important in terms of being able to help you with your own self-identification and self-confidence is not exactly the word, but certainly the way you see yourselves and your people, to be able to see yourself and other people who look like you doing incredible things.
Talk about the disciplines that are represented in this year's festival.
Every year, historically, NBAF has always had five primary disciplines: music, dance, film, theater, and visual arts, and sometimes literary arts as well. But those first five have always been our primary disciplines, and every year we present in each of them.
This year, your emphasis on jazz is really exceptional. Talk about the Spotlight Series and the idea behind that.
So this is the inaugural year of the Spotlight Series, and what we're doing is every year we're shining a spotlight or placing special emphasis on one particular discipline. And we'll do that by tapping a master artist to come and perform and curate a number of experiences for NBAF audiences. So this year, our inaugural spotlight curator is Wynton Marsalis, the great jazz trumpeter. He was wonderful. He immediately gravitated to the idea, and he was thrilled to be asked to be that inaugural curator and very excited about that. So we are especially grateful for him, really, for giving instant credibility to this new idea around a spotlight series. And so he has tapped three other incredible jazz artists to come and perform. Jimmy Heath, 87-year-old NEA jazz master, still performing, still teaching, still traveling. He will come here August 23rd. He has tapped Marcus Roberts, who is just an incredible jazz pianist. He's coming in September. And then he has tapped his younger brother, Jason Marsalis, who does the vibraphones.
The youngest brother, I think. I believe he is. I think he is the youngest of the six Marsalis brothers.
All of whom
have gone into their father's line of work.
Yes, all of whom love music and thrill us with their music.
You had a two-week workshop, spoken word workshop, in which you brought together, I don't know whether it was an audition process, but it was certainly a screening process that identified a number of young people in Metro Atlanta. Yep. to develop their talents as spoken word artists. Talk
yes.
about that.
So we're really excited. One of the things that's at the heart of the new NBAF and the way that we're approaching the work that we do is through partnerships. So we're really delighted to be in partnership with Youth Speaks, which is the nation's premier youth spoken word organization out of San Francisco. And so together, Youth Speaks and NBAF, along with a smaller local institution, organization called Atlanta Word Works, we put together a two-week intensive spoken word workshop, like you mentioned. And it was an incredible thing because we had 20 young people who are poets. And as it relates to kind of Black culture, oral traditions and storytelling has always been a part of what we do. And so on the spoken word piece, these young people got together, were trained by master training artists over 2 weeks, and really got to sharpen their own voice. They basically were in a writing workshop, wrote pieces of their own, practiced publicly presenting those pieces, and ultimately did publicly present in front of an audience at the Center for Civil and Human Rights at the culmination of the 2 weeks. But the important piece of it is helping those young people actually find their own voices and develop their own voice and be empowered through that experience.
Please put your hands together for the indomitable Jemiah Tooks.
Post me up. Put me on a pedestal with your feet on my crown of thorns. I am here for your sad debasings. Call me clay. I am here for your remodeling and remolding. I reside in the minds of white professors and black people that want to call me bougie, toiling every day with the strength of 100 unfreed slaves on my cotton-speckled school ground.
All right, so coming to the stage, everyone, please give a warm round of applause for DeQuadre, y'all.
A kid who effortlessly accomplishes feats and constantly sets goals. The kid who was ahead of his class and at the top of his game in a world willing to cause him pain and instill in him fear to where he's scared to reach for his dreams. Hungry for success, thirsty for attention, will he try to fit in? Will he try to pretend to be someone he's not, only to be shot down by the accusations and aggravations of society?
Next up to the stage is one of the most caring, most present, and most conscientious young people I've ever met in my 16 years of work. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together for Miss Sharice Foster.
I heard once from an 11-year-old boy that the minute we stop learning is the second we start thinking. And I just want my two younger brothers, best friend, and every black man in this room to think. Not learn, not assimilate, think. Man isn't definable by books, but is found in oneself.
What else should people be looking for that you're excited about this year?
So there are a couple of other things that are new that NBAF is pursuing. One is a program that we call NBAF Global. So again, we have always been about the diaspora, but it's sometimes easy to forget that and think that we really are just about African-American experience, maybe particularly in the last several years. So we are also creating this NBAF Global, and every year we're going to focus on one corner or region of the diaspora. So this year, our NBAF Global Weekend consists of a one-day film festival all around the power of music, since music's the spotlight. But it represents films from filmmakers across four different continents. And then the Sunday of that same weekend, August 17th, we are really shining a light on reggae music. And so we're bringing in Maxi Priest and Third World and Atlanta's own Julie Dexter to perform at the Tabernacle. And it's just going to be an all-out reggae extravaganza and jam. And then another thing that NBAF is really doing much more aggressively starting with this year will be commissioning new work. And so we've got several commissioned projects that we will be putting onto the stages this year. One is a dance project called Doxology. And that's in partnership with Spelman's Department of Drama and Dance. We're doing a new project also called Game On. It's a commission with the Kennedy Center in D.C. and High Arts, or the Hip Hop Theater Festival out of New York. And it's a hip hop theater piece. And it's taking the voices of young people in New York, D.C. and Atlanta and presenting their thoughts, their words, and several of the young people who just went through our Brave New Voices workshop will actually be on the stage as part of Game On here for the Atlanta premiere.
I have to tell you, as I watch you talk about these things, the excitement,
yeah,
the energy, your body language,
yeah,
is really wonderful to watch. There's no question that you truly love the opportunity to do this.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, I just think there is no such thing as quality of life without the arts. And people don't generally think of themselves as artists. I don't think of myself as an artist at all. And yet, if you think about what would your day be like without some kind of art in it, you fail to think about the fact that we all have music that we listen to. We're riding along in the car. We're listening to music, maybe, if we're not listening to great shows like this. You know, we have music downloaded on our iPods. I mean, we're looking at paintings or pictures that we have hung around our homes. I mean, art is all around us, but we don't necessarily give it, we just don't necessarily pay attention to it the way that we might.
Have we reached a point where black artists are as celebrated and recognized in mainstream culture as white artists, in your opinion?
Some for sure, but I would say that the vast majority are not. I mean, yeah, you've definitely got your artists that are household names that everybody knows, and everybody,
Spike Lee,
yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, Beyonce,
popular culture,
yeah,
sure.
Absolutely.
Sure.
But there's a lot of people every day who deserve to make a living doing what they do who aren't getting the attention and aren't getting the opportunity. And that is where a National Black Arts Festival can come in and at least help elevate and support what they're doing and give them some opportunity. There are a lot of artists who have been on NBAF stages in the past who were not who they are now. And who would say that, you know, being at NBAF and being on our stages did help, in fact, to raise their visibility and help to catapult them. So we want to continue to do that kind of a thing.
Sonia Halperin is chair of the National Black Arts Festival, which is now underway at venues across metro Atlanta. You're listening to Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. We'll be back in a minute with a tribute to one of Georgia's iconic political leaders. Today is the anniversary of the birth of one of the seminal figures in contemporary Georgia history. Herman Talmadge was born on August 9, 1913, in Telfair County. In his illustrious political career, which stretched from 1950 to 1980, he became known as a progressive Southern leader, even as he began his career as a staunch segregationist. Talmadge was formally elected governor in 1950. He followed in the footsteps of his illustrious father, Eugene, who won the governorship four times in his career. In those gubernatorial years, Herman Talmadge was a man of his times, clinging to a Southern way of life that was facing its first challenges from courts.
Time for the Longines Chronoscope, a television journal of the important issues of the hour. Our distinguished guest for this evening is the Honorable Herman Talmadge, Governor of Georgia.
In 1954, Governor Talmadge made his views clear in this rare excerpt from an appearance on a nationally televised TV broadcast.
The Supreme Court is due to make a decision pretty soon, sir, on segregation in the schools. Now, how do you, Georgian, think that decision is going to go?
Well, anticipating what the Supreme Court will do, all you can do, Larry, is follow legal precedents that have existed for a great number of years. Without exception, they have held that the matter of segregation in the common schools of our state is a matter that addresses itself to each state and not to the federal government. Nowhere in the federal Constitution is the word schools or education or anything of that kind mentioned. The Constitution hasn't changed. The laws have not changed. Sometimes the political complexion of a court does change. Sometimes it may be swayed by political pressures or sometimes by sociological opinions. But if they follow the law, as all lawyers understand it, they will uphold the present method, which is separate but equal schools, and each state themselves may determine whether they want to maintain and preserve segregation or whether they want to change it.
Governor, assuming, however, that this decision does go against you, what plans have you?
Well, we haven't made any particular plans as yet because we don't know what the decision will be, but we have tried to be forearmed. And then in addition to that, the last session of the General Assembly submitted a constitutional amendment to the people of our state for their approval or rejection, which will enable the General Assembly in its discretion and in its wisdom to utilize tax funds for the payment of tuition fees to private institutions if that becomes necessary.
Well, that is going to be a very difficult system to set up, I suppose. It's going to be very expensive, sir.
Anything the Supreme Court does to thwart or change our present system of state control of our educational systems will be the most difficult thing that we in the southern states have had to approach or deal with since the war between the states.
It will affect something like 12 million school children, about 17 states and the District of Columbia. Now,
it's a tremendous number. Actually, 17 states have mandatory segregation. Four states have permissive segregation, but at one time the overwhelming majority of the states in the Union had segregation. Now the white people in the South and also the Negroes in the South want it left alone, just like it is.
Governor,
a few agitators, white and colored, want to change it.
Governor, this means, in effect, that your state would set up a private school system.
I don't think there's any doubt but what my state would do so if they had to maintain segregation. We intend to maintain separate schools in Georgia, one way or another, come what may. A lot of people that aren't familiar with it don't realize how far-reaching or deep-seated that is for both races.
But it was also Talmadge who pushed through Georgia's first sales tax, a groundbreaking initiative for a Southerner of his times. Talmadge used the revenues from that tax to fund Georgia's public schools, which had never before received state support. Despite his segregationist views, the tax allowed Talmadge to give the state's black teachers equal pay to whites in the system, an unpopular move at the time. Talmadge went on to the United States Senate, where he served from 1954 to 1980, and during those years, he sponsored the bill creating the nation's food stamp program. At the same time, he supported legislation that forced able-bodied recipients to work for their welfare benefits. Talmadge lost a bitter re-election battle to Republican Matt Mattingly in 1980 after being censured by the Senate for allegedly accepting reimbursements for expenses he never incurred, and after an all-too-public divorce that left him tarnished in the voters' eye. Talmadge died in March of 2002, and a few weeks later, I sat down here at the GPB studios to talk with two men who knew him well, journalist Bill Shipp and Rogers Wade, who had been Talmadge's chief of staff in the U.S. Senate.
Why are we remembering Herman Talmadge as one of the great people of Georgia politics?
Herman Talmadge was one of the great progressive transition figures in the history of Georgia. He saved Georgia, in my opinion, from going down the road that Mississippi and Alabama did to racial ruin.
A progressive at a time when there were not a lot of progressives in the South.
Absolutely. He had an ability to see things and see what the second page was every time he looked at something. He could get to the bottom line of almost anything, and much to your chagrin, if you happen to be a staffer who had spent the weekend studying everything on a piece of legislation and thinking you had every answer known to man, and 15 seconds after you put it on his desk on about 6 o'clock on Monday morning, he would say, "What about so-and-so?" And you go,
What exactly, we say a progressive at a time when there weren't a lot of Southern progressives, but what does that mean precisely? What was he doing that others weren't?
Well, make no mistake about it. He was an arch segregationist at a time when the whole political office in the state, you had to be a segregationist.
Right.
In 1948, many of the Southern states, led by South Carolina, decided to bolt the Democratic Party. They assumed that Herman Talmadge, this fiery segregationist, would follow them. He did not. And he helped break the back of that Southern breakaway movement that might have killed the Democratic Party right there. He saw the handwriting on the wall. He saw a change coming, and he was a man of his times who could change with the times.
Well, and that, of course, is the point. And that's why this is a guy who embraces the modern history of the South, really, throughout his career.
Well, he looked at what was happening, as Bill said, and looked at the root of it, and education was the bottom line. So he, in a very bold and tough move for the time, instituted the first sales tax that Georgia had ever had, and it was to finance schools, roads, create jobs. And it was a step that had never been done. It wasn't done anywhere else in the South. And it probably paved the way to a modern Georgia.
You cannot overstate the importance of the passage of that sales tax, which allowed the state for the first time to have a major cash infusion to improving the infrastructure, transportation, education, public health, all sorts of things that needed to be done. Talmadge was able to do that, or to start doing that, through that sales tax, which took a great deal of courage to enact.
Talmadge was a person who believed in the touch of people. He didn't believe in doing a 10-minute piece. He was really kind of pre-television in his campaigns. He'd stop at courthouses and see people and walk through and say hi to secretaries that were in there and ask them about their cousins. It was that kind of a politics, and it really paid off in seeing the the touch and feel of Georgia.
Yeah, Bill Shipp, you know that there's not a journalist in this state, and for that matter, anyone who knew Herman Talmadge, who doesn't try to do a Herman Talmadge impression, people who knew him. I mean,
there is one who doesn't.
Oh, that's you. Well, I wasn't about to ask you to do it, but the point is, it's interesting that that's another part of him that'll be remembered for a long time, the way he spoke. He had a unique way of speaking and a unique way of expressing himself.
If you want to hear Herman Talmadge, listen very closely to Roy Barnes. When Roy Barnes makes a speech, he sounds very much like Herman, but he sounds identically to his father.
Gene.
In that same kind of rolling populist rhetoric, sort of accusatory sometimes and laudatory, with those wide, broad Southern A's. He's exactly like Talmadge in that way.
You have to remember that both Gene and Herman Talmadge were Phi Beta Kappas. They could talk to anybody about any subject, and it sounded like they came from next door.
Are there giants of politics waiting to happen like a Herman Talmadge in this state?
You know, I hate to say this, but I don't think so, because I think the media have changed the texture of politics so that you could run a political campaign, and many do, run a political campaign without ever pressing the flesh.
What are you going to remember most about him, and what are you going to miss most about him?
He was a great boss, a mentor, a teacher, a friend, and I have missed in the last couple of years of his illness, particularly being able to sit down and just talk about things that are going on and get his opinions about what's happening. He remained very sharp right up to the very end.
I think he's going to be regarded as, if not the greatest governor of the 20th century, certainly one of the greatest.
So today we remember Herman Talmadge. That's all for us for this week. I hope you'll come back again next Saturday at 4 for another edition of Two Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Have a good week.
All you Georgians, let's do it right. Herman is our leader and we're sure to win the fight.
Who is the governor of Georgia, H-E-R-M-A-N?